Hello and welcome back to a new episode of the CTO Show with Mehmet. Today, I'm very pleased joining me, Christian Hammer. Christian, thank you very much for being with me on the show. The way I love to do it is I keep it to my guests to introduce themselves because I have a theory. No one can introduce someone else better than themselves. So tell us a little bit about you, about what you do currently, and then we can take it from there. So the floor is yours.
Awesome. Well, today I'm the CEO and founder of Ball AI, which is focused on eliminating tech debt because, well, tech debt sucks. I've been in software dev in some form or another for 30 years. I actually first wrote my first application. I think I was like 8 or 9 years old, but professional career started about 30 years ago. And in one form or another, I've been doing that ever since, either as a hands-on coder early in my life, but often as a leader. And most recently as the CTO at TradeLens, which was a global consortium between all of major ocean carriers, IBM, AP Morgan, and World Bank.
Again, thank you very much for being with me here today, Christian. Now, the way, you know, I like to do some research before we do the actual recording, of course. And, you know, I went to your website, actually. And, you know, I'm a big believer in purposes and why we build things. And, you know, one thing I've seen on your website is like you want to redefine software management with AI. And this is, to me, like it's a very strong mission statement. So yeah. Tell me a little bit more about, you know, first of all, you mentioned technical debt sucks. And of course, all of us, we agree with that. But there must be something, you know, very strong, you know, that pushed you and said, hey, I need to start this. I am on a mission to change things. So tell me about this and what's the role of AI in all that?
Certainly. So I mentioned at a very young age, I got the opportunity to learn how to program. I'm very young, 8 or 9 years old. And I loved the experience of creation that was possible because I had learned the arcane technical knowledge of the computer. I could speak its language and get it to do the things I wanted to. And what the modern LLMs have allowed us to do is to break down that barrier. Now the computer can actually understand the language that we speak in the way that we speak it. You no longer have to speak computer. You no longer have to learn how to code. Now, it's not entirely true, right? Like you still, even the best code assisting AI tool can't build an enterprise application. It can't connect up a bunch of distributed or unique different pieces of technology and craft them in a way that is well orchestrated. And that's actually what Vol is doing already, is we're taking a look at the entire enterprise architecture for large companies and telling them where they have technical debt, giving them kind of a, I'd say it's the Darby Dragons view, because in old-timey maps, that they would have areas that were unexplored territory and they'd draw little monsters or put little dragons in it in areas where there was unknowns and therefore danger. And from a enterprise architecture perspective, those unknowns are dangerous. They're places where I don't have a team working on it. I don't have appropriate testing coverage. I don't have, you know, all the things that I need monitoring and instrumentation. And so they represent discrete portions of tech debt. But tech debt takes on many forms. Some of it's just patterns that we've changed over time or technologies that we've decided to update. So we, on the other side of the spectrum, within the organization at the developer level, we have an AI code review tool that actually sits within Git and helps you match the patterns and do the best practices of the company, make changes that are suggested from that higher level architectural view on maybe replacing a library that you're using as a better choice or whatever. Like it's pointing out where there's problems that you can address at that moment. I say that we're trying to transform that. They like want people, you know, businesses with very large tech organizations are notoriously slow. And that's largely due to things like technical debt, but it's kind of absurd that the bigger the technology organization, the longer it's been around, the slower it moves. We're in the business of automating things and making things move faster. Therefore, the more of us that are working on it, the longer we've been working on it, the faster, more efficient it should be. But in truth, it's been the opposite. And I want to make that true because I think it's nuts to have a huge amount of humanity doing efforts. It's things that aren't creating any new value, aren't helping the world become a better place. And one of the main drivers for me in this most recent company was my wife has, So she's got Alphabet Soup after her name. She's got so many advanced degrees and professional certifications attached to her name that it looks like Alphabet Soup. But when she gets hired by a major company to do what she's this extraordinarily knowledgeable and experienced person with, she ends up just managing old broken technology that was implemented at some point in the past that was supposed to do something related to that. And so she ends up helping the technology along instead of the technology helping her along. And that's backwards. We don't create these technologies to give us work to do. We create these technologies to do work for us. And that's what we're trying to make sure happens. We're trying to ensure that that's actually what occurs.
Yeah, you know, you reminded me of, you know, of the discussion that was still, it's ongoing since years, you know, regarding the technical debt when, you know, people were talking about COBOL, the language usually banks they use, and the problem how, you know, this technology gets really stuck in you know, in that area and no one was able to change it. But from the other side, Christian, like how really, now jokes aside, this technical debt, what could be the negative impacts on the long run? So you mentioned a couple of things. You mentioned that they will be slow to adopt new things. So there must be some technical aspect of, you know, change, and could be also some business, you know, impact on yeah, you know, being slow. So walk us through like both these two sides of the road, I would say.
There's actually a lot more to it than that. So I usually talk about how much it slows down. Now, a business, no matter how well established they are, is going to make changes to their strategy. And it's often happening on a quarterly basis. This is caused by market changes, consumer sentiment changes, demand from their shareholders, whatever it is. The business is not a static thing. Yet, our technology evolves at a much slower rate than that. If every quarter we're making a minor adjustment to our strategy, our technology is not advancing that. We can't replace the ERP solution we have in place when we go from being wholesale to direct consumer because we're making that kind of massive strategic change. So that's a big part of it, is we're just not able to move the technology at the speed of change the business needs. The other part is that, well, technology is just a process. I mean, as we develop technology, as we're writing code, we're learning more and more about the business as developers and as technologists, and we're getting more specific. And as you do that, you have to adapt technology as you learn, right? But I thought we were going to do it this way. I thought that's what the customer was asking for or the user needed. And I found out later that that wasn't quite right. Or what also occurs quite frequently is people leave the organization. Whether it's the person that was using the tool or the person that developed the tool, when they leave, a lot of knowledge is lost. And so a lot of the reasons decisions are made gets lost with that. And so technical debt comes in myriad forms. Some of the most impactful and most important ones, though, are simple things like legislation change. There's new requirements on privacy around data in the EU. You know, that's not new today, but that happened fairly recently. And those types of things have a profound impact on what the technology itself has to do, how it protects the data, how it shares the data, how it moves the data around, for example. And if the technology can't adopt at that rate, you're in breach of major laws, subject to fines, litigation, all kinds of fun stuff. Then there's also the security vulnerability piece. People are finding especially with new AI tools, people are able to find exploitable opportunities within existing systems at a much faster pace. And if we can't respond in kind by being able to fix and patch those problems at speed, then our systems become much more risky to exploit through cybercrime. So there are many ways technical debt can impact business, and some of them are existential, right? That litigation problem, that problem of the laws changing and us having to adapt, or the cybersecurity risks can put a multi-billion dollar business.
Absolutely. Christian, one thing, you know, again, to the point about innovation and AI, I want a little bit to you know, kind of bridge two ideas together, I would say. Now, we've talked about, you know, the technical debt and its impact. And of course, you at Fellow AI, how you are on this mission to do this. Now, but if we want to take more a kind of a 30,000 feet view, I would say, and if I want to look at the broader landscape, how do you see AI in general impacting, you know, innovation across different industries? And do you think like this is something that can go in the same speed and pace across all industries, or, you know, some they will go faster while the others will be kind of a little bit last movers?
That's a tough one to answer. I think it falls down in the same way that when the World Wide Web action happened. In 1994, the first browser came for Local Zay. And all of a sudden, all industries started transforming. Some of them very, very rapidly because they were largely just information industries anyway. You think of things like news and message passing, things like that, where it was just information. And so, of course, it was going to be disrupted earlier. Things like, I don't know, selling furniture are going to be much, much later because the traditional process of buying something like furniture doesn't happen in a way that's easily moved to the web. Similarly, I think that our industries are going to be affected by AI in a sequence of, I would call them tiers of industries. There are those that are easily disrupted by this technology now because what is being done today without AI is easily reproducible with today's AI. Customer service is an area where I would expect there to be rapid replacement with AI. And that's happening. Research and writing, things that are easily done with AI tools today, are going to be rapidly disrupted. I would argue that like a lot of software development, and especially the things around software development, QA and the automation of that, DevOps and the automation of that, those are going to be rapidly changing because of tools like AI. But I think that like any other technology that humans have created in our long existence, there's a huge upside as well as there's the risk that comes along with it. And the upside is that I think that it largely frees us from the mundane and trivial tasks. Like the fact that I can write software in a dozen different languages is it's cool for me, but like it's not cool. Like my wife gets a benefit from that other than the paycheck that I was able to drop. The ability to use the technology in a way that it understands us and it can derive the intent from that and then act on that is a huge enabler of innovation. And I'll use an example of how I've seen this in action at a large company. When I was at Nike, I was brought in as their entrepreneur to what I say, inject a digital DNA and build up their direct-to-consumer digital organization. They have incredibly intelligent people, very passionate, very creative people throughout the organization, and marketing and design, and, you know, all across the org. And then we have the digital team that was there, you know, building tools. But when you can bridge those two teams, where you can take the technically capable person individuals, and you can pair them with the people that have the great problem that needed to be solved and that, you know, maybe technology can solve it. When you pair them together, you were able to do amazing things and whole new product lines, whole new innovations in the industry occurred. Nike ID came out of that, which is the design a shoe on an app or on a website and then have it delivered to your home. That was somebody in the design team that came to us and said, I have this idea. And then the digital team was able to disrupt it. Taking out the need for us to go to a group of people, which has cost and time association, and be able to use a new technology like AI to do that, like freeze innovation up at a rapidly accelerating pace. And at some point, theoretically, you have, you know, AI could do it on its own, where it's transforming entire industries without the need of human intervention, although I do think it takes human need, desire, and intent to drive it.
Absolutely, I agree with you, Christian. Now, it's good that you mentioned these examples. I don't like ask loaded questions, but I have to merge these two together. So Okay. Now, how important culture is in this? Because, you know, like, you just said it, but you might have like smart people, bright people over there. But, you know, sometimes we feel, and I always talk to startup founders always about importance of the culture of innovation. So how important the culture of innovation to be within any team, whether they are in a startup or whether they are in a big organization? But and this is how I relate to the second question. And why usually large organizations, you know, adopting and scaling innovation can be challenging. How you advise them to handle that, I would say.
Yeah, there's so much there. And it's actually been a tough nut to crack for most people that have been thrust into a role like that. So whatever you're brought in to become like an innovation leader, like I was with that old Nike and many others in the past, you're asked to change the culture, frankly. I mean, it goes right to that point. The culture of a large organization is really impacted by the people that are there, of course. I mean, the culture is not in a vacuum. It's not something that exists without people. The people are the large, you know, driving factor in it. And why large companies tend to have issue with innovating is multi-pronged. So the first is, who are they disrupting by creating this new innovation? If you're a company, if you're a company like Nike, that's 90% of the basketball shoe market, disrupting that industry means you're disrupting yourself. And you've built an entire company with many people's jobs tied to the performance, KPIs, sales targets, whatever they are, around continuing that, you know, dominance. And if you come in and you fundamentally put that at risk by disrupting it, by innovating in it, you are like, you're really upsetting a lot of people. So within the organization, it's hard to overcome that for good reason. You're also putting at risk the revenue associated with a company. It's very difficult to overcome that. So that's the first part. You have to overcome the existing mountain that is that company's success today. The second part is that a large company is usually drawing a certain type of person towards it. Now, if you're drawn towards innovation, disruption, and you're very comfortable with change generally, because that's what you're trying to drive, and you don't go to a big company to do that for a bunch of reasons. But the first is, it's very difficult to do that there. But the second is, big companies are much more known for being stable, reliable, comfortable, and safe places to work. So the type of person who applies for a job at a big company doesn't tend to crave change and to try to drive and innovate. So you have the problem of the people that have been drawn towards it. So how do you create that culture, that cultural shift in that space? Personally, I had cheat code that I used. I would look for one major technology project that needed to be done for whatever reason. And I would bring in an outside like solutions integrator or something like that, because they brought in new blood. You know, I'd bring in contractors that were, you know, at a large agency where they get to see many different projects across many different industries and many different companies. They've been implementing best practices with the newest technology, and they have a very certain, you know, profile that they tend to fit, which is one that you want in that innovative transition you're making in a big company. So you bring in that new blood as part of that effort. And the other big thing you were able to do is eliminate a big chunk of technical debt. And one of my favorite projects to do in the past was like a cloud migration from an on-premise data center, because it forced you to look at all the different pieces of the technology stack and evaluate whether or not you should replace it wholesale, if you could move it to the cloud for whatever reason it's possible to do that. So you had to ask a lot of tough questions of the business. The combination of erasing a big chunk of the legacy technology and bringing in a new perspective often gave you the critical mass you needed to shift the culture in a meaningful way. The other thing that I would do if that didn't work, you tried a couple times, but the other thing is to try to, I don't like creating like a startup lab within a company, but it can work. And that's why I ended up doing it at Nike, was we created Valiant, which was a digital innovation lab within the Nike company. But you have to have engagement from the rest of the organization. It can't be done in isolation. You can't just say, okay, we're going to go over here and we're going to think smart thoughts and we're going to come up with something. No, you needed that input from the business on things, problems that they were dealing with and opportunities to transform in an interesting way. And the best way I found to do that was to really treat it like almost like hackathons, except much more like a pitch deck, you know, somebody coming in with a pitch like Shark Tank almost, and then pitching it to the development team and the development team breaking up into teams to go chase the different opportunities that they're present a like a very basic prototype. And then everybody decide as a group, like which one we're going to invest in long-term to build out. And that gave the people within the organization like a big profile bump. If you worked in the innovation team, but your project got picked up, that was a very cool thing. It could show up on your annual bonus, like as a, hey, you had this big impact. Potentially, if it was the one that got picked up, you probably get pulled into the team for a duration, which was a neat new opportunity for you too. So it was a good way of injecting a bit of excitement into people that otherwise wouldn't have been, I would say proximate, but hadn't been close to an innovation center like that, and give them all the, you know, the social benefits that go along with that, as well as potentially the financial ones. And so there are many ways you can attack it. Those have been the two that I found have been the best way to try and solve the culture problem, because bare minimum, you're going to have to change some amount of technology, some amount of people if you're gonna impact the culture in any meaningful way. And your point earlier about like COBOL in the stack, there are some places where the legacy technology is intractable, and you're gonna have a very difficult time ever replacing it, because the individuals who created it and anybody who even evaluated are long since out of the workforce, and you know they can't come in and tell you why technology does what it does. That problem, letting that piece of tech dead, is the most difficult part. And if your culture is very, very tied to those legacy technologies for whatever reason, like in banking they tend to be, it is near impossible to make that shift.
Absolutely. On that point, this I face it because I worked in the field, you know, and the last thing you mentioned, I used to see it a lot. And now another thing, you know, which a takeaway I can say, companies that I've seen, they do what this kind of, sometimes they call them like entrepreneurship programs within the organization. So at least, yeah, you know, they encourage, you know, people to go and come up with new ideas, and they don't call them hackathon necessarily. But yeah, now there's an element, I think, Christian, which is also important, which is leadership. I mean, from leadership perspective, sometimes you need to do a balance between innovation and at the same time, you know, you have the board and, you know, you need to go there and tell them about also the risks associated to that. Mm-hmm. Now, from your experience, like, what is the best way to have this balance between, you know, innovating and the realities, I would say, of proper risk management, and probably maybe sometime it's like resource constraints within the company. So how they can still, you know, manage to be innovative and, you know, be in this culture that you just mentioned.
Yeah, so you're always up against that risk versus reward problem. When you're a smaller organization that doesn't have a lot of revenue, you have a lot of customers, the risk level is pretty low, and all the, everything's potential, everything's opportunity. Once you're at a certain scale, that inverts, and your board becomes a lot more, paying a lot more attention to the risk side of it. And as a CEO, you end up spending more of your time trying to mitigate risk than you do about like trying to increase productivity or trying to transform the world in a meaningful way. But this is actually the innovator's dilemma, or what often happens in big companies and big industries, is they get intractable, and then somebody comes in and fundamentally alters the entire industry by being super disruptive and innovative. And so what you have to always keep in front of the board and the other executive leaders when you're in that role is, every time we're not the ones doing the major innovation, we have to have a strategy to respond to it. Either we're going to have an acquisition strategy to go acquire the people that are doing this, and that's not a bad strategy. That actually works very, very well. Is let somebody else take the risk, let them figure out the right way to do it, and then we're going to acquire them. But you better be ready to acquire them and integrate it directly, so you got to have that plan in place. Or we have to be the ones doing the disruption, because that innovation, that disruption is an existential risk to the business. So when you're putting it on the tally sheet and trying to determine like, well, how risky is it to do this thing? I would always say that we're risking the entire business by not doing it. Somebody else could come in and completely obliterate our market position if they did this thing. And that's what you're going to be measured against. So if you're looking at something that's pretty minor, the opportunity there, you're looking at going, well, okay, moving this direction is going to give us a 5% revenue bump. And if we lost it, it's going to hit our top line revenue by, you know, 1 or 2%. That's not worth risking business over. But if it's something that you look at and you go, oh my goodness, it has the potential of pushing us out of the market because it could be self-transformative. A good example of a place where that happened in the early 90s was in the United States, we had USDEX, which was the Yellow Pages, the phone book. And in 1996, they had the opportunity to buy, I don't remember which of the companies it was, but it was basically a company building a phone book online. And they laughed because they were the dominant, like everybody has a phone book, yet they're everywhere. 2 years later, they were effectively out of business because all that information had moved online. And it was largely because the company didn't understand what really was the value they created. It thought of itself as the physical phone book rather than the information within it. So it's very critical if you want a company to stay on top of its market, if you're already there, or to become top of the market, is to understand the value you provide. What are you giving your customers that nobody else is? And when you know that, you can evaluate everything that's coming up and decide whether or not it's a risk or not. If the board doesn't understand that, if you don't understand that, you have no chance of having that conversation. So it's critical you have that first, but then you just weigh it against it. Is this an existential risk or not?
Now, let us look at all this, you know, fast moving changes with AI from a little bit founder or entrepreneur's perspective. So how do you think, you know, to be founders or existing founders, they can cultivate on this speed, especially, you know, and it doesn't matter whether it's in the B2B space, in the D2C space, you know, are you seeing, you know, some opportunities for more startups that can leverage this to serve whether like B2B or B2C customers?
I actually have a whiteboard in my office here that is covered in concepts, the areas where there are specific pain that can be solved with a clever AI solution. Unfortunately, I'm going to give the opposite of what normal advice and probably give, and I'm wearing the hammer. But the issue is when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And with AI, everything looks like it should be solved by AI. It's very much one of those hammers. And the last thing you should have is a technology looking for a problem to solve. But in this particular case, there's so many opportunities. There's so many things that you could be doing with it. And that it's not a bad question to ask. Right up front, there are areas within our information society that are very difficult for people to overcome. Now, Google search was the dominant information finding, fact finding paradigm of the last, 20 years. It was the dominant player there. I believe that in this new world in which I have an AI tool, and maybe it's voice, maybe it's chat, whatever, in which I can ask it to do anything for me. I'm thinking of like the Rabbit, what was the R1, the little handheld AI phone.
Yeah. That's coming out.
I think of the capabilities of that and say, okay, great. Now, how do I get accurate information about the things I'm going to ask it to do? I'm planning a trip to Bangalore and I need a, you know, hotel, flight, rental car, whatever. When I get there, I'm going to ask this assistant to do it. And maybe it knows enough about me to make good decisions, but how do I find out if my dominant way of getting information is now through that tool? So finding ways of solving that information and trust issue that comes along with information. One of the reasons Google was successful is they cracked the trust problem. A lot of the earlier search engines like Ask Jeeves or Yahoo Search, or there's a whole bunch of them, they just weren't as good convincing you that the information they were sharing was accurate. They didn't create that trust. And I believe that in the AI space, we're going to have a very similar thing where I might get to trust that handheld device because it's with me all the time. Like, I do trust my iPhone and the various apps on it because I use it all the time. But when it comes to things like brand awareness, what's the best quality service I'm going to get, those things need to be addressed with this new technology in ways they haven't been yet. That's the first place I think of, because it's the first thing that gets transformed. That information piece is the first industry that will get fundamentally altered by this new technology. So what are the other places where information is the thing being passed around? Advertising is another one. Advertising in the world of, you know, search was dominated by SEO, you know, search optimization, Google ads. When social media came out, you also had, which honestly, social media is in a way another form of content proliferation and sharing that search was also doing. Just it was my friends telling me it was valuable information instead of Google search telling me it was valuable information. But that how do I find out about the things that I might be interested in, and how do I find out if it's the things that are right for me? That's been handled by advertising in most of the world for the last, you know, 60 years. And advertising hasn't really changed a lot in that time period. But now, with our different way of accessing all the information that's available in the world, there has to be another way of doing that discovery. That's just information. So it's going to be around those spaces first. Although, you know, with the rate of change that's happening within the AI space already, who knows? Like, in 6 months, we might be talking about how, you know, we use AI tools to design furniture that's printed in our homes for all I know.
Yeah, this is my problem whenever I discuss AI on my podcast. I need to push it out as fast as possible because I'm afraid that we discuss something and, you know, after 2 weeks or 3 weeks from now, things completely change. So absolutely. And by the way, just, you know, I will give an example. Today, I mean, early morning for me, you know, I've seen this tweet about on X about, I think it's called Devin, you know.
Devin, man, that was an eye opener because it was something I was trying to build a year ago and I didn't think it was possible.
And you know, like now from concept perspective, I repeated this multiple times. Even I remember the exactly same time last year, I was still doing solo on my podcast. I wasn't having the interview format because I started to read about the concept of agent in AI, and you know, like there was Auto GPT, there was Baby GPT, these kinds of things. Now, regardless of what framework people were using and talking about, what attracted me was the concept of having multiple AI agents that they talk to each other, and then, you know, someone can orchestrate pretty much same as a product manager in software development. And then you give a task to UI guy, you give another task to you know, the software engineer to write the code, and then you might give it to a QA engineer. And of course, like probably there will be a way to talk to customers also as an agent as well. And we've seen some example of this. Now in the middle of this storm, Christian, what is the future is holding specifically in our jobs as technologists? Like, I mean, do you think we're going to become all of us product managers having ideas, or even I would say, product managers, chief technology officers, that we have ideas, we just give it to AI and AI will boom, build it to us. Is this where we're heading really?
Yeah, it is. So I went down that same path when it was Baby AGI and those different tools came out. I actually created one also called Brother, and it was kind of making fun of Big Brother and some of the other names that were given to AI bad sci-fi movies. But the reality is that statement I made earlier about the non-technologist is going to be able to sit down and tell the computer what it wants, the way that it, you know, in a way that the person understands, the computer will learn, you know, it'll understand, be able to respond to. Devin was just the newest example of that same thing, you know, of Baby AGI, Brother, being able to take your intent. Now, Brother did the exact same thing you were describing. That's one that I abandoned as a product idea almost right out of the gate, though, because It's very possible today to build a tool like that that builds a simple solution and sits down and makes a app maybe, but to build something that can coordinate the actions of a bunch of enterprise technology solutions like ERP, CRM, you know, all the pieces of the logistics chain like WMS, et cetera, that's a different beast. And I do believe though, that that's happening very rapidly. The technology is evolving towards that. I wrote a paper 3 or 4 months ago talking about ASA, which is on-demand software adaptation, where the technology will be, by using a bunch of AI agents, the technology will adapt and change based on input from customers, the business, and report bugs and all that, that it'll use agent architecture as a kind of a swarm sitting over top of it. It'll constantly be updating it and fixing it. And that's already happened. Devin was a great example of how that'll be done too. So what does that turn our kinds of roles into? There is still the need for the high level architectural understanding of how it all interconnects. You're still going to, for a considerably long time, have systems throughout it that still need to be integrated with, still need to be understood. And somebody's got to do the check on it to make sure it's not going haywire, going nuts. And somebody's going to have to be directing it towards better, more efficient patterns. Now, that doesn't mean that a solutions architect AI won't exist. That's actually almost exactly what we're building at Full AI. those types of roles will be informed by AI better than more than they'll be replaced by AI. That's actually a critical distinction. I don't think Devin on its own is going to be a complete replacement for software engineers. You're still going to need somebody. It's like a senior software engineer versus a junior software engineer on a team. Yeah, the junior software engineer can write code, but man, I don't necessarily want to go into production without a senior software engineer going, "Oof, don't do that." Do this instead, right? There's going to be a period of time, and probably the next 4 or 5 years, where that's actually critically necessary. But after that, I don't know. 5 years out, you're talking about AGI being live everywhere on every part of this. And at what point does the hue and involvement of somebody like a CTO need to be there anymore? I think the role turns largely into more of an administrative evaluator of what's happening and whether or not it's gone haywire or not. It's more of a management than it is of a technologist type role at that point. And it is closer today to a product manager than it is to the CTO of my past. And tomorrow it'll be much, much closer to that. You'll see more of a CPO than a CTO need.
Yeah, so it's like we still need someone to be the mind behind or the doing the steering, I would say, to get things. Now, aside of AI by itself, it's something, but I know you like to talk about this, Christian. I think there's a lot also of other emerging techs, deep techs, whatever you want to call them, that they are also emerging. And I think with AI, they would, accelerate us even more than we are already in an acceleration mode now. From what you are seeing, because you interact with a lot of companies, you interact, with a lot of other tech leaders. And I know you have your own podcast also as well. So what you are seeing from trends perspective in these emerging techs and what we can expect to be the next big thing?
Yeah, so there's no question that quantum computing is going to have a massive impact when it finally reaches a level of supportability and, frankly, existence that it's out in the wild. It coupled with AI has potential to fundamentally it was called escape velocity. It has the ability for the technology to transcend the ability of the human's comprehension to understanding what it's doing. And that's not that far away. The coupling of that with things like IoT, the Web3 trends are quite fascinating to me. They're kind of a reversal of what's happened with the internet over the last 20 years. So, sorry, this is a topic that I care about, but I don't like the direction it's gone. The initial internet was meant to be a way of distributing knowledge and having it broken up into many different compartments so that it couldn't be controlled from any one entity. You couldn't have a government come in and censor all information, for example. It was done for military originally because they needed that ability to have like a you know, an entire army get captured and not lose all the information and still be able to connect up the rest of their orcs. And over time, though, the web became something that became largely centralized because of platforms like Google and Facebook, where most people spend most of their time when they're on the internet. The trend in Web3 towards like a decentralized view of the web, edge computing, and having like information stored, you know, for you in your environment, is a fascinating thing that has the potential to, again, fundamentally alter the way that we access information on the world. And the fact that we can move it onto our local devices, our phones, and we can travel around with that knowledge and information and, you know, interact with each other in interesting ways has a lot of potential, but I'm not seeing it turn into anything meaningful yet, unfortunately. The activities of building like NFTs and coins, like, you know, all the various coins, I think it's just complete nonsense because they're taking something that was meant to be a simple task, the transfer of value in the form of like money from one party to another. It's very easy with paper. It's very easy with our existing technologies, and they turn it into something very difficult. So that was a weird direction to go, but the technology is still out of potential. When you add in things like drone technology and some of the very rapid advancements that are happening with battery tech and even wireless charging, there's a drone technology company. I think they were based in Russia. Now they're based somewhere in the United States, where the drones can stay up perpetually because they're using wireless technology to charge the batteries while it's in flight, so they don't have to come down and land. When you start coupling these things all together, you start to have, like I said, there's a point where the technology reaches escape velocity and it transcends our ability to predict where it's going to go. The sci-fi world of my youth is already the truth, and we're past it in a lot of ways. And the sci-fi world of tomorrow looks like magic to us already. So there are a lot of technologies that are fascinating. Vision, most of them are really closely tied to AI, though. The self-driving car is still kind of in the future, but you know, I own a Tesla, and when I first got it, I could summon it. It still does that, right? So it can drive itself to a degree. That can change entire industries, make our world safer. The eVTOL flying technology eliminates the need potentially for roads. There's so many things happening, and it's happening so fast that it's actually very difficult to stay on top of anymore, which is exciting. Right?
It is very exciting.
Because you can't predict it. You look into the future and go, well, what's going to happen in 5 years? Like, 5 years is an insanity. Every 3 months, the advances in AI are so profound, they're hard to imagine. Denim came out a week ago, and it's, you know, it's something that none of us thought would happen for 5 years, just 3 months ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I remember, you know, when I decided to start my podcast, and it was like beginning of 2023 when still ChatGPT was new. So, you know, like I was saying, okay, I think the trend in 5 to 10 years. And then I said, hey, hold on 1 second. I think I need to change this statement because 5, 10 years is infinity, as you said. And then once I start to have guests, I feel now I can't even ask for 1 year. I should ask in a couple of months from now because things are moving so fast. And you know, to your point, Christian, like a lot of things are changing. And you know, when you mentioned like your sci-fi of your childhood is already there. And actually, yes, like I remember, you know, watching the cartoon with people, you know, talking using their watches, and you know, having this thing you put on your head, and then you start to see a different world, like all what you're seeing with like the Apple Vision Pro and all these things, talking to a computer and answering you in a smart way. What could I say? Like, this is my childhood at least, I would say.
The one I left off, but I've been involved in for a very long time. I got involved in robots at a young age too. I got involved in a lot of competitions where I started the robotics club at the university of that type of thing. And then when 3D printing came into the world, I had worked at Tektronix, had their color printing imaging division, and I took a year between high school and university. And that year I worked in the prototype lab, which was an amazing experience, building advanced color printers, basic, you know, desktop printers, right? But advanced ones. And we had built some very, very, very early 3D printers kind of by accident. The layers of ink were thick because it was meant to print on t-shirts and mugs and things like that. And on one of the things we were printing, which is a board, I think, it built up a bunch of layers. And one of the engineers said, oh my God, we can print in 3D. And that turned in, like, a whole industry has come out of that. And I think that the future of 3D printing or advanced manufacturing as a whole is going to have, it's another one of those things that has a profound impact on our entire lives. And I go actually back to the Nike ID product, because the idea for that was not, I designed it on a phone and then a month later it shows up at my house after being made in a factory in China. The goal was I designed it on my phone and I go pick it up in a Foot Locker in 30 minutes. I go pick it up at a local store. That was our goal. But that meant you had assembly robots and 3D printers and, you know, things that can sew and cut and do all the parts of making a shoe there. So advanced manufacturing is one that I'm really excited about. But it's taking a lot longer than like AI. Like AI is transforming things every 2 weeks, and advanced manufacturing is on its second decade already.
it's almost daily basis now, like almost daily basis. I keep track as much as I can, of course, but sometimes I figure out during the weekend, oh, I miss on this and I miss on that. Oh, you know, I need to go and review and prepare better next time, I say to myself. Kirsten, you know, it's like a very rich and insightful discussion today. If you want to leave us with like one advice and word to fellow founders and fellow CTOs or anyone who's interested in this field, what you tell us and where we can find more about you.
There's lots of ways you can find more about me, christianhammer.io or podcast.techtastic.tech. Or follow on dashingi.com or all good places. Also on LinkedIn, I'm CHammer1. The thing that I believe everybody with is this: we don't know where the future is going. It's impossible to predict because it's happening so fast. It's happening to us. The most important thing you can do is keep learning, keep evolving. And if you're building a company, know that there's no such thing as a durable moat. Anybody can, because of things like AI, they can reproduce your technology in a matter of weeks and months. So always be evolving. Always be innovating. That's how you win.
Absolutely. It's something that I think it's important more than any time before. I'm a fan of, you know, being in what I like to call the blue ocean space. And now with AI, to your point, you really need to be doing something. Of course, I'm not saying they will not be able to copy you, but you need to be really innovative. You really need to come up with crazy ideas, I would say, to be there. So thank you for this advice, Christian. I really appreciate the time that you spent with me today and all the stories and all the experience that you shared with us. I really appreciate that. And final word, this is to the audience. This is how I usually end my episodes. So if you just discovered this podcast by luck, thank you for passing by. I hope you enjoyed. Please, if you did, subscribe, tell your friends and colleagues about it. And if you are one of the loyal fans that keep coming back, thank you very much for your support and for your advices and for your suggestions. Keep them coming. And stay tuned for a new episode in very, very soon time. Thank you. See you. Bye-bye.
Hit that subscribe button. Share the show with your tech-savvy friends and fellow entrepreneurs. And leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. Your support means the world to us.